Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, underneath a big clock at the corner of 5th Avenue and 22nd Street, I stood and waited for a girl I knew at the spot where we agreed to meet. It was 2:04. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And our third co-host, Joe McCormick, is not with us today. In his place is an extraordinarily long quote.
Yes, I figured since we would save time with Joe not introducing himself, I would take that time and repurpose it for an even longer quote from one of my favorite bands of all time.
Fair enough. You know, someday we should really put together a playlist of all of the songs that we've
I've
mentioned.
Quoted, yeah. Some of them are not safe for work. Like, I try to avoid those, but sometimes when I get a little rambunctious.
Punchy.
A little punchy at the
full
end of the week.
Of vim and vinegar.
And especially when it's like 2 minutes before we're supposed to start recording and I realize, hey, I don't have a song lyric to go at the front of the show.
I have to admit that every single time Joe and I are podcasting alone without you in the
studio.
Which
you will be doing very soon.
We will, because you are going on vacation next week.
I'll be cruising around.
That is, I believe, where Joe is right now, although he could be following my footsteps to Europa. No, every time that Joe and I are in the studio alone, like we always, it's like Noel hits record, Noel, our super producer, and then one or the other of us goes, we haven't chosen a quote yet.
Why did Jonathan start that as like a standard way of opening the show? What I should do is also go back and find the first episode where I did that and just start writing down, like, how many times
have you used the same four songs?
Right. I know that there are certain songs I've used more than once. And in fact, I almost started this one with a song I'm pretty sure I've used before. But all of that put aside,
yes,
we're wasting time, and time is precious.
Time is so precious.
Every second counts.
And every millisecond, every nanosecond counts.
And we're learning that what we think of as a second may not actually be a second.
No. Well, kind of. Okay, so news broke at the end of May of 2016, the year which we are recording this in, that researchers had created a new clock so much more precise than existing clocks that we're like maybe going to have to change the definition of a second. And that got us thinking about the history and the future of timekeeping.
Right. And this also means, by the way, that if we have to redefine what a second is, by its very nature, we are eventually going to have to redefine what a New York minute really means.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
It's not that our idea of what a New York minute or a second is wrong.
Right.
A second is a second. Mm-hmm. It's the machines that we use to tell time that are wrong, or at the very least, imprecise. So, okay, you know how digital clocks that aren't connected to the internet, like the clock in your car or an analog wristwatch or a wall clock, analog meaning like has hands and gears.
Like it's the kind of clock where you look at it and then you think, I remember I used to know how to tell time this way.
When I was first writing these notes, I originally started to type old-fashioned and then stopped myself before I felt so ancient.
Right. Well, you could at least say, like, when Mickey's big hand is on the 2 and his little hand is on the 3.
But so these clocks that aren't connected to the interwebs slowly go off time, right?
Right.
And that's because the mechanisms that drive them aren't quite measuring seconds correctly, and the difference slowly adds up until it's noticeable to even our very slow brains.
Right, and we could be talking about fractions of a second of an error, but eventually those fractions of a second add up to a second, and eventually those seconds add up to a minute. Now, this takes a lot of time depending on how precise that clock happens to be, but even if you're talking super small errors, it does add up over time.
Oh, absolutely. And while it may not be terribly important to us, there are mechanical applications, or digital applications rather, in which it becomes very, very important.
Yes.
And clocks these days are even old-fashioned analog clocks are really pretty good at doing what they do. But that has not always been as precise the case.
Yeah, as it turns out, if we want to talk about the way we are now being able to define a second and keep that time as precisely as we currently know how to do, it behooves us to look back into our distant past and learn about the history of time keeping.
Yeah, because the concept of a second is, like, in the grand scheme of humanity, relatively new.
Yeah, especially when it comes to time. In fact, the original version of a second had more to do with geography than with time passing. So, you know, I was gonna bust out the Wayback Machine.
Yeah?
But I don't know. Do you think it could handle a trip all the way back to ancient Egypt? I mean, we haven't taken it that far back in a long time.
I don't think I've ever taken it that far back. Do you think it's safe to be in the Wayback Machine and talk about time that much? Do you think it's gonna get mad at us?
You could get a little timey-wimey. You know what? You only live once. Into the Wayback Machine you go.
Okay.
All right, now we just have to. Here's the problem: all the digits are hieroglyphs when you want to go to ancient Egypt. So it's
crap.
Let's see.
Failed.
Ticked off kitty cat, snake head person, and block. All right. I got it right on the first try. Okay, so here we are back in ancient Egypt. Now, to be fair, we believe that timekeeping may go back further than the ancient Egyptians, but it's so uncertain that I don't even trust the Wayback Machine.
There's a possibility that the Sumerians had this covered, pretty much.
Right, but we don't have any evidence of the Sumerians actually building any sort of timekeeping device of any sort.
Also, my cuneiform is really rusty.
Yeah, I'm barely hanging on with the hieroglyphs as it is, so. One thing that we should mention, though, about those Sumerians, they had something that will later on factor in importantly in the timekeeping discussion. They loved the number 60 a lot.
Like a whole bunch.
Yeah, the Egyptians loved the number 12, and the Sumerians loved the number 60. And 60 is kind of a cool number. It makes it really easy to deal with certain fractions because there's so many numbers that are that 60 is divisible by.
Oh, yeah.
So 1 through 6, uh-huh. All of those are divisible, or 60 is divisible by all of those. 10, 12, 15, 20, and 30, which starts to sound familiar when you start thinking about clocks.
And so this base of 6 kind of concept is something that was adopted by a lot of civilizations from that time and location.
Right. The Babylonians, they said, hey, you know, we didn't dig everything you Sumerians did, but we like this sexagesimal base system. So we're going to use that for our astronomical calculations. When we're exploring stuff in the sky and we're describing how it moves and the relationship of different stars to one another, this is the base system we're going to use because it makes it very easy to divide by all these different numbers.
Sure. And kind of based on that, the Greeks also picked it up.
Yes. And so that ended up being very important further down the line, but we'll rejoin that because that's like medieval Europe, y'all, when we have to get to the point where we're applying it to time.
Oh, yeah.
So if they weren't using it to describe time, what were they using it for? Well, besides the astronomical calculations, they were starting to talk about using it to describe geometric features and also the describing geography itself.
Not just space geography, but geography right here on Earth.
Yes, so that you could be able to say things like where one place is in relation to this other place, other than just, all right, you're going to go down this road a ways
for about 5 minutes, and then you're going to take a right turn at the ye olde Krispy Kreme.
If you see a guy playing a banjo, you've gone too far. Turn around. Come back. Yeah, that's that.
I wish that I knew the ancient Greek for Krispy Kreme.
Yeah, or banjo. At any rate, the sexagesimal system was used to help define these things. And Eratosthenes used the system to divide a circle into 60 parts to create a geographic system of latitude. Hipparchus normalized these lines, making them parallel, because before they were kind of wavy. They essentially
a little bit loosey-goosey.
Well, Eratosthenes used them to connect places that he thought were particularly interesting, which didn't necessarily mean they went in a straight line. They might lean a little to the right. They're like, hey, this place is kind of cool. You might want to check that out, too.
That's so great.
Yeah, so Hipparchus was like, no, we're going to normalize this stuff, make it a lot easier. And he also developed a system of longitude, which had 360 degrees. Then you have Claudius Ptolemy, who expanded on this and subdivided the 360 degrees of latitude and longitude into smaller segments. So he divided each degree into 60 parts, and each of those 60 parts he subdivided into 60 smaller parts.
Okay, so that's where you get minutes and seconds.
Right. The first, the larger subdivisions were known as the partis minutae prima, or the minutes. And then you had the second ones known as the partis minutae secunda, or second minute, or later just second. But it would take more than 1,000 years for that stuff to be actually applied toward timekeeping. It was really applied toward map making and geography.
Okay, but so, I mean, around the same time-ish, stuff was happening with early forms of clocks.
Yeah, sort of. The Egyptians, you know, if we look around right here, you just look a little bit over to the right, okay, you notice there's that big tall obelisk over there?
Yeah.
All right, so that obelisk, it's for a real important reason. It's there to tell you when it's in the early part of the day versus the later part of the day.
What?
Yeah, in case you're not aware that it's now later than it was earlier, you can look at the shadow that
is cast. I've taken naps where I've gotten up really confused.
Right.
So actually that could be very helpful.
That moment where you wake up and you aren't even aware of which pyramid you're sleeping.
I know,
let alone,
right?
Like what time of day it is.
Yeah.
So yeah, these were very basic clocks. They essentially divided the day up into before noon and afternoon, but they also would show when the longest or shortest day of the year happened to be. If it was the longest day of the year, the shadow would be shorter. If it was the shortest day of the year, the shadow would be longer.
Ah.
So you could tell kind of the time of year.
Like, yeah, like what season it was. Sure.
Yeah. So you'd be like, wow, it's really cold out. Also shortest day of the year. Interesting. So the sundial itself would show up in 1500 BCE. So this is like 2000 years after those obelisks were the early stages of timekeeping. Now, this is also courtesy of the Egyptians, so we're just going to stay here and chat about it. The device, the sundials, had multiple divisions on it to help divide up the day a little bit better. Also, once you got to noon, you had to turn the sundial 180 degrees around so it would continue to keep time properly. So this is a first instance of having to wind a clock so that it keeps time.
Uh-huh.
So the Egyptians divided the daylight hours into 12 segments. They were really big on that number 12, remember, which is fortunate since, again, 60 is divisible by 12, so that'll come in handy later. So they thought, let's divide up the day into 12, the daylight hours into 12 segments. So there became 12 periods or hours of daylight in a day, but since the amount of daylight changes throughout the year, that meant the length of an hour changed throughout the year.
Ooh. Okay, so light time was 12 hours, or
yeah,
12 periods, and then night time was 12.
Nighttime at first was nothing. Nighttime was just not the day.
Was just go home,
yeah,
kids.
It's just like there's nothing to do, go to sleep. You know,
candles are expensive.
Right.
You don't have Netflix, go to sleep.
We have only so much oil to burn. Go to sleep. And at first nighttime was nothing. But then the astronomers in Egypt, they began to develop tools where they were studying the movement of stars, and they divided up the nighttime hours into 12 as well. So you had 12 nighttime hours, 12 daytime hours.
For a total of 24 periods in a day.
Right. And they, again, were not fixed length, right? Mm-hmm. It all depended on what time of year. So literally in the summer, you had longer hours than you did in the winter. So time did not pass the same way from the perspective of counting the hours. It passed the same way in a different sense if you're not concerned about what quote unquote time is it.
That's trying to think about going about your day like that is very confounding to me.
Well, as it turned out, most people back then really just need to know, is it early enough for me to do work? Is it getting to the point where it's going to be too hot to do work? Is it the time to eat? Is it the time to not be awake anymore? It really was pretty, you know, there weren't a whole lot of Evites that people had to respond to with yes, no, or maybe. They were really kind of simple in that way. Now, the Greeks were the first to introduce the idea of fixed length hours, but they did this so that they could make astronomical calculations. They didn't do it so that people would keep regular time. In fact, most people didn't bother with that. They stuck with the more casual variable hour system. And in fact, that would hold true until the Middle Ages. But that's not the only type of clock that was around at this time.
Oh, yeah. Also, right here in ancient Egypt, where we absolutely are, were water clocks that were probably developed here. Again, you know, like, it's basically whatever you dig up is your evidence for what was developed when.
And if it didn't survive, then you have no way of knowing.
Yeah. But so one was a water clock was definitely found in Amenhotep the First's tomb, dating from around 1500 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
And they water clocks covered a few of sundials or astronomy clocks' pitfalls, because you could use them when it was cloudy. Crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And you could also use them as stopwatches. The Greeks would later pick up on them too, though not until around like 300 BCE, we think. And they called them klepsydras, which I love, which basically means water thieves.
And it's interesting they're called water thieves. It's specifically because of the physical way the clock keeps time, right?
Yeah. So the idea here is that you've got a stone bowl with a very small hole near the bottom through which water would flow at hypothetically a kind of sort of more or less constant rate.
Right.
You put this bowl with a hole in it inside a larger basin that's filled with water, and the water will slowly fill the bowl.
Mm-hmm.
If the inside of the bowl is then marked with lines, you can tell the rough passage of hours by watching the watermark.
Yeah, I've seen a similar one where it was, again, going back to the Egyptian times, where you had a container with a very small hole in it, and it would allow water to flow through one container into a second container, and the second container would have a bobber in it.
Oh, sure, that had a watermark that could tell you.
Yeah, you'd look at the bobber and you'd say, all right, so three marks have gone by. We're going to call those hours. But keep in mind that these devices also weren't precise timekeeping devices. They gave you a rough idea.
Yeah, and I'm sure that, I mean, you know, as water wear would change the shape of the hole of the given device, your concept of a period of time would also change. But okay, so supposedly devices very much like this were used to time speeches in courts of law circa 430 BCE in Athens.
So even in ancient Greece, we told our politicians, yo,
hey,
shut up.
For serious.
Come on, man. Sit down, John.
I think we're going to finally have to leap ahead a little bit. Do you want to save it for medieval times, or do you want to?
You know what? We can save it for medieval times. I'm a little partial to medieval times.
Okay, fair enough. So I'll just mention that these water clocks went mechanical after a few hundred years by letting water, the Grecian water clocks, I should say, by letting water drip measuredly into a chamber, like you were just talking about, you can raise not just a little bobbin, but like a floating piston and therefore do simple work like pushing a marker or even a gear to turn a pointer. And so between like 100 BCE and 500 CE, Greeks and Romans both were trying to make the flow more constant by regulating the water pressure. And as a result of that, some of the devices that they were making could like ring a bell or a gong when the water would hit a certain point, or they would even like push a mechanism to open little decorative hatches containing small figurines that would dance around or move astrological models.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And meanwhile, in China, mechanical water clocks were also in use from around 200 through around 1300 CE, including at least one that used this big old water wheel, like story and a half tall water wheel, to power dozens of elaborate sounds and mechanisms that would dance around and do weird little stuff.
Man, and I thought the church near my neighborhood, whenever it's noon or 6 p.m., it goes pretty much bonkers with its chimes. I imagine it had to be even more spectacular with something along those lines, although maybe not necessarily quite as regular.
Yeah, I would imagine not, but still a party.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get back in the Wayback Machine. We're going to actually jump ahead to medieval Europe.
Okay.
And we'll get out there. So that's
okay,
a lot
easier.
Okay,
did you bring your nose plugs?
Come on. I work the Renaissance Festival. I've been to Dragon Con. I can handle medieval Europe.
Okay.
Here we go. Welcome to medieval Europe. Huzzah. Where food is on a stick. And this doesn't look like the Renaissance Festival at all. This is kind of awful.
Yeah, I don't see any chicken fried bacon.
There's actually awful in the street, in fact. That's the kind of awful this is. Anyway, so
this is worse than our pus field trip.
Yeah, that was, man, you never thought you'd look back on that with, like, nostalgia.
Nope.
But here we are in 14th century medieval Europe. This is about the time where mechanical clocks began to become a thing. And at those, in those early clocks, they had hour markings. Some had minute markings.
What?
But none of them had second markings.
Certainly not, yeah.
And so it would actually take about a couple hundred years, really 16th century medieval Europe, where you started seeing minutes as a standard marking of time. And this is where we take that concept we talked about with the geography, and it was converted into a timekeeping concept. The idea of, well, we've got these 12 periods of daylight and 12 periods of nighttime that the Egyptians had proposed. The Greeks had formalized that into actual fixed length hours for their calculations. We're going to do that for the purposes of keeping time. Then we're going to subdivide that. And because they were working with 12s and 24s, they said, how about we look at 60? We're looking at, you know, a division of 60 smaller increments that make up one full hour.
And that became minutes, yeah.
And then eventually you think about that long enough and you realize, all right, well, we can subdivide that even further. A minute is still a pretty long amount of time, depending on what you need to do, right? Mm-hmm. Some things, a minute's no time at all. Right. If it's something really fun that you love to do, maybe you're riding on a horse, jousting, you're Henry VIII, a minute is like no time at all.
Sure.
But maybe you're being accused of witchcraft, being dunked under the water. A minute's a really long time.
Oh, at that point, you're going like, can we break this period up a little bit?
Yeah, maybe we can look at like a 15 second interval if you're going to be, you know, slowly like drowning me. Like, I'd like to, can we negotiate this at all? So they looked at the round face of the clock that they had designed and the division of the day into really 12 segments. You can think of 24, but really most clocks are 12 segments, right? Mm-hmm. And then we just amend either AM or PM in our brains to denote whether it's in the morning or it's in the evening. And they adopted that sexagesimal system. And each hour was divided by 60 into minutes and divided again in 60 into seconds. And this was the first time we really had a definition of a second in terms of timekeeping.
And all of this, I imagine, was also partially driven by just the mechanical complexity of clocks and the capacity. Because a mechanical clock, if you guys aren't familiar with the inner workings of a your basic wall clock or watch or something like that, is based on a coiled spring that you apply tension to by either winding it or exposing it to some kind of electricity,
right?
Like electrical pulses. And then in the case of these earlier clocks, the capacity of gears that you attach to the spring to react in regular movements.
Yeah, it's kind of like a transmission.
Sure.
You know, you use smaller gears and larger gears to dictate exactly how frequently a gear will turn within a given amount of time, assuming that, in fact, the clock is wound. And
right.
Then you get the mechanical performance where it rotates once an hour for that, you know, for the little Mickey arm.
Yes. And so as the spring making and gear making techniques became more complex, I'm sure that people started going like, surely we can make this more complicated.
Yeah.
Let's put some seconds in there.
And in fact, you know, for a lot of people, seconds weren't really that important. Not yet anyway. As much as I joked about the whole dunking of people to see if they're witches or not, that was not really on the forefront of people's minds in that particular scenario.
Weird.
Yeah. But the second was really thought of as important for making those astronomical calculations. And in fact, we attempted to standardize it with the International System of Units. And the definition for a very long time was that a second is a fraction of a mean solar day in a tropical year. But all of that changed in 1967. So I think we should probably just jump in the Wayback Machine, go back to the studio.
Okay. That's fair. I'm pretty much done with history for the day.
I think we can talk a little bit about the 1960s, but you know, we don't need to go there. That's not that long ago.
Yeah.
All right.
The smells will be barely exciting.
Yeah.
Okay, we're back.
Man, I just realized I've seen the Beatles. Huh. Oh, well. Oh, well. Another time.
Yeah, sure. We can always rev it up again. Okay, actually, before we talk about the 1960s, I need to talk for a second. About the 1940s, because in 1945, there was a physics professor at Columbia University by the name of Isidore Rabi. Mm-hmm. I think I'm saying that right.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, he proposed that a very precise clock could be constructed by measuring the vibration of atoms.
Wow.
And as far back as the 1930s, he'd been experimenting with this discovery that when some atoms are exposed to some wavelengths of electromagnetic energy, those atoms vibrate very, very consistently. Mm-hmm. So you can measure the oscillations and then use those to build a standard for the passage of time.
And what is actually happening here is that if you have the right frequency of energy hitting a particular type of atom, it excites the electrons in that atom to higher energy bands. And then those electrons will come back down to their normal energy band. That's the vibration there.
Right.
But if you're talking about a resonant frequency we talked about resonance before. Resonance is this idea that you have found a frequency that resonates with a particular material. In this case, we're talking about atoms, and it makes them vibrate themselves. So, for example, we see this in the macro level with the opera singer singing that note that is resonant with a particular crystal glass, and it causes the glass to shatter.
Sure.
Same sort of thing, except instead of shattering atoms, you're just making them wiggle a little.
Wiggle. Yeah. Very precisely.
Yeah, and very quickly. Yeah. Very, very quickly, as it turns out.
So based on all of this, in 1967, the International System of Units wound up changing their definition of a second to to a particular vibration of the cesium atom, or a cesium atom, a given cesium atom at any given time. And these suckers vibrate so consistently at when exposed to certain wavelengths of light. And so a second was defined as 9,192,631,770 cycles of those vibrations.
Well, there's your problem. I lose track right around 4 billion. I just lose interest. But no, that's amazing. The thought of being able to define a second as something that is more than 9 billion vibrations of a particular atom. Now, you might wonder, how the heck can you turn that into an atomic clock?
Yeah, how do you measure that? That's pretty weird.
So I'm going to do my best to describe this. Please keep in mind, I was a liberal arts major. So here we go. First, these are the earlier atomic clocks I'm going to talk about now. We have a different type of atomic clock we'll be chatting about shortly, and then an even more advanced type of clock to talk about the future of the second. But first, you would heat cesium so that atoms would boil off of the gas, typically.
Okay.
And you would pass that down a tube that's maintained at a high vacuum.
Sure.
So then you would use magnetic fields to sort through the cesium atoms and passing the ones with the right energy state to the next level. So in other words, you're separating out ions from regular cesium atoms.
Okay.
And you want just the specific ones that are going to react to the microwave radiation you're going to pass through it. So once you've sorted them and all the ones that you want are going the right pathway, the atoms will then pass through a microwave field that has a varying frequency within an extremely narrow range of frequencies. One of the frequencies within that range is that magic 9,192,631,770 hertz that corresponds with the vibrations of the cesium atom. So when a cesium atom encounters a microwave at that frequency, it changes its energy state. It wiggles. And the atoms continue on And another magnetic field separates out those that had their energy state altered by the microwaves and the ones that did not have their energy state altered.
So the wigglers versus the non-wigglers.
Exactly. And a detector picks up those atoms, the wigglers, and that output is data that is proportional to the number of cesium atoms striking it. In other words, the output says how many atoms were wigglers.
Okay.
And then that way you can actually start to tune your device so that it is closer to the proper frequency. And you'll see that number go up.
Okay.
That number goes up because you'll hit more cesium atoms with the right frequency. You start to narrow it down till you get just the right tuning. And once you're there, you stop. You have reached the point where you are creating the pulse that is a second each time.
Huh.
So what you would do is you would take your frequency number that you had arrived at, and the number of that really big number we've said a few times already.
Mm-hmm.
And when you divide the two, it should end up being one. That means 1 second, right?
Huh.
So it's a little weird to think about. But, yes, it all comes down to how many of those wigglers are you picking up. And as you pick up more and more, you get these pulses that end up being exactly, or at least mostly exactly, 1 second. It turns out that as we get better at measuring things, our definition of what exactly is changes.
I know. I love that.
So atomic timekeeping created a new approach called coordinated universal time, which despite the fact that would usually make the acronym CUT, C-U-T, it's actually UTC. That's what's universal time coordinated, I guess. In the United States, we depend upon the U.S. Naval Observatory's master clock and the National Institutes of Standards and Technology in Boulder, Colorado, to regulate our time. They're the ones telling us what time it is, in other words. So, interesting fact, UTC and astronomical time don't quite match up. So,
okay.
So we've got a second that is very precise, but when you change it to the real world and the way that the Earth rotates, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. The Earth does not rotate according to our beautiful math, in other words. So once
Earth
in a while, yeah.
Once, can't trust it for anything.
I know. I'd leave, but it's where I've got all my stuff. So it turns out like every now and again, we have to throw in a leap second.
So a leap second.
A leap second.
Okay.
So every 10 years or so, you've got about 8 minutes out of that entire decade where some of those minutes, those 8 minutes, they actually have 61 seconds as opposed to 60 seconds.
Okay. So is this because these clocks aren't quite precise enough? Even though we've gotten this precision down to the vibration of an atom, they're just not as precise as they could be?
Well, that's definitely part of the problem, because as time goes on, the slight imprecision of these clocks becomes more and more noticeable, and you have to correct for that. And it's really interesting that such a thing could even, like, it's so hard to imagine something so small. We're talking about the difference of nanoseconds here.
Oh, yeah.
Could actually matter that much. It's almost like if you were to look at, say, an ant, and you said, well, that little tiny ant couldn't do anything to me. And then you saw 10 million ants,
and
you thought,
like, oh.
So when there are 10 million of them, they actually do matter. It's sort of the same with these nanoseconds. But let's talk a little bit about a slightly newer version of atomic clock, the microwave fountain clock, which does not involve putting one of those little fountains from like a bookstore or something inside a microwave. Don't do that. That's not how you're going to get a microwave fountain clock.
Okay.
That's how you're going to get a broken microwave.
Okay, duly noted.
All right. So they use a slightly different method, but they still depend upon cesium atoms and microwaves. So you take cesium gas, and you introduce it into a chamber that has 6 lasers all mounted at right angles to each other. So you've got like up and down and some on the actual walls pointed inwards. It looks like a James Bond trap. But instead of saying, no, Mr. Cesium, I expect you to die, the lasers are actually slowing down the movement of those cesium atoms.
Okay, so it's an atom trap, not a James Bond trap.
Exactly. And we also know that movement and heat are essentially the same thing, right? As atoms move, they're warm. When you start to slow them down, they cool down.
Okay.
So the goal is to cool them down to close to absolute zero. Once they're at that point, they are forming into kind of balls of atoms. So you've got these little cesium gas balls that are suspended, you know, because they've been slowed down so much.
In the chamber, yeah.
And then you use a couple of lasers to push them up into a microwave chamber. This is the fountain action.
Okay.
So if you imagine a fountain that's just shooting straight up, the water shoots straight up. In this case, lasers are pushing that cesium ball up into the microwave chamber. And then those particular lasers, the ones that are pushing the cesium atoms, turn off. Then you've got microwaves within that chamber. Some of the microwaves are at the proper frequency to make cesium vibrate. And when they do encounter the cesium atoms, the atoms will change energy states. And as those cesium atoms leave the microwave chamber, they encounter yet another laser.
Okay.
We love our lasers.
We do.
Cesium atoms that have been altered by the proper resonant frequency fluoresce. They light up. And a detector makes note of that. And then the system is dialed in. So it sounds very similar to the old atomic clock, right?
Sure, sure.
They dial it in until that maximum fluorescence is achieved. And that defines the natural resonance frequency of the cesium atoms and can be used to define a second.
Huh. Okay.
But these also, as accurate as they are, they do not keep time
perfectly
forever. Yeah. They do lose time. Over time. And we're talking about like a nanosecond a month, which seems like nothing. I mean, I was going to waste it anyway.
I was probably spending that playing Bejeweled.
I was probably playing Overwatch.
Okay. But it does add up
eventually,
and especially digitally. So nonetheless, okay, we should say that atomic clocks are really cool for a number of reasons. I think number one, because they are what keeps our geosynchronous orbiting satellites basically not running into each other.
Right, yeah. When you're talking about things like satellites, like communication satellites, or you're talking about GPS satellites, you need to have extremely precise timekeeping in order for those operations to work properly.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, this comes with a whole host of problems and challenges. But you're looking at an accuracy that needs to be down to billionths of a second. So when you have like a nanosecond error in there, that's actually a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
So each GPS satellite actually has 4 atomic clocks on board, and there are 24 GPS satellites in orbit.
Ooh, okay.
And a GPS receiver on the ground can determine its location by triangulating broadcast signals sent from multiple GPS satellites. And then what it does is it looks at the timestamp on each of those, factors in how long would it take the signal to travel from that timestamp and where you would be. You actually have 2 answers to that,
mm-hmm.
but one of them happens to be inside the Earth. So your GPS usually ignores that answer.
Generally.
Yeah, it says like, all right, it obviously can't be that one, so you have to be here.
Right.
But knowing that you have these potentials for errors, you actually, that translates into a less precise positioning when you're getting your readout. It may be accurate to just a few meters,
mm-hmm.
which is fine if you're traveling around and you're driving. And, you know, generally speaking, you're not going to have an issue where you're suddenly realizing you need to turn a mile back.
Oh, sure. But it does explain why, for example, if you have your Wi-Fi off, your GPS may think that you're on the other side of a bridge that you haven't crossed yet or
right.
something like that.
Or
will read you the same instruction off twice because it's just glitching as to where precisely your car is.
Or if you're using something like a car service app and you see where you are and you know where you are based, like you see where you are on the map and you see where you are in real life. And you realize that if you pin the point that it shows you on the map, you're going to have to walk another block to get to that car. You're like, no, I want the pin to be right here.
Right here.
Yeah. Those apps are particularly bad at that. I don't know what the issue is. I don't know if it's on the app side or if it's my phone's GPS. But anyway, so one of the cool things about space and satellites and time is that you have to take into account both special and general relativity.
Oh, that's always exciting.
Because it messes with time. So
right. Okay. Because satellites are moving relative to a single point on the ground.
Yes. Yeah, well, and if you're talking about a geosynchronous satellite, it's moving, like if you were looking up, you would always see it, right? If you were directly below it, which means it actually has to travel faster. It's going a further distance in the same amount of time. So it's traveling faster than the Earth's rotation.
Sure. The same way that a track runner on the outer side of the track is going to have to run a little bit faster than the inner track runner to keep up.
Exactly. So you start to think, all right, we're talking about time dilation here. How big a problem is that? It's pretty huge. So we just talked about how a nanosecond a month was a big deal.
Uh-huh.
So first of all, you have to look at special relativity. That's the one with the time dilation effect. That's when you're talking about the speed.
Okay.
That ends up about 7 microseconds of difference. That means the clocks aboard the satellite due to special relativity will move 7 microseconds slower than a clock on the ground.
All okay. Right?
So that means you have to figure that out, factor that in, except you also have to remember about general relativity. Now, general relativity tells us that the satellite is orbiting high above the Earth, where the curvature of space-time is less than what we experience here on the Earth's surface.
Due to gravity, sure.
Exactly. The Earth is a giant mass. For us, it's a giant mass. For the sun, it's nothing. But for us,
it's pretty big.
Again, it's where we keep all our stuff. So the Earth's a pretty big mass. So
a clock here on the ground, the clock on my wrist, if I had such a thing,
yeah,
would be,
it would actually be going faster.
It would be going faster
because of the
moving.
Curvature of space time.
Right.
So it would actually be going, your wristwatch clock would be going slower than the one that's aboard the satellite. So special relativity says that the clock aboard the satellite is going to go a little slower than ours, right? That's the whole idea, that if you were to travel at near the speed of light and came back, less time would have seemed to have passed to you than to everybody on Earth.
Uh-huh. But according to general relativity, it's the clock in the satellite is going faster.
Exactly. So
how much faster?
45 microseconds.
Okay, so you have to split the difference.
Yes, exactly. You've got to take the 7 microseconds where it would have been going slower and the 45 microseconds where it would be going faster, and you come up with 38 microseconds difference. And so GPS systems take this into account. I know I just said GPS systems and it's like saying ATM machine and PIN number, but it doesn't matter.
That's not what I was cringing at. I was just, I just, the math caught up with me.
Yeah, 38 microseconds difference. So you have to account for that. And we're looking for an accuracy down to 20 to 30 nanoseconds. So nanoseconds are much smaller than microseconds. It's a big deal.
And real errors would pile up due to these mistakes.
Yeah, exactly. So if we did not correct for this, on the first day, we'd be thinking, all right, well, this isn't great, but it's usable. And then as the day goes on, we'd be thinking, wow, this is getting less cool. And then the next day we'd be thinking, this is completely inaccurate because the errors would be enough to account for a 10 kilometer error per day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So these little bits of time really make a big difference.
Huh.
Which is why you want to have a really precise timekeeping device. So one way that they correct for this is they actually make sure that the clocks aboard the satellites tick at a slightly slower rate before putting them up in orbit, because then general relativity will take care of the rest and they'll start ticking at the rate that they should be ticking at. Which is kind of like, you know, that sort of thing where you've already planned for the thing to go wrong. Like, you're not trying to stop the thing from going wrong.
You're just like, well,
this is going to happen. So here you go.
This is what my life is now.
That's just how physics work, y'all.
Yeah. Okay. But that's not even, atomic clocks are not even the most precise type of clock that human people have created.
I know where you're going, and I'm already crying.
I know it. I'm sorry. And you got to the notes faster than I could, so it's your fault, really.
Yeah. All right. So the clock that inspired us to do this episode,
right,
is a type of optical clock.
Optical clocks?
Yeah.
Aren't I looking at the clock on my wrist, hypothetically, if I had such a thing?
I'm using optics right now. These depend very heavily on lasers. And
again, with the lasers.
So we had in our notes how they work, and I almost just put a frowny face next to it. Because I started reading how this works, and it's so complicated that, first of all, I got to be upfront. I do not understand it. All right. That's just me being, I'm being straight with you guys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Neither of us are laser physicists.
Yeah. I'm not a laser scientist. Okay. Yeah. I'm not a second scientist either. But they're very, very complicated. And as I was reading it, I just realized that it would take me probably weeks of study to really get a basic understanding of what's going on here. But, they work with lasers and atoms and specific frequencies. And here's the problem. It's so technical. There are phrases like optical frequency standards, forbidden transitions. I didn't know there were such things. Doppler broadening and optical clockwork. And I'm pretty sure I don't understand any of it.
Yeah, forbidden transition sounds like something out of Welcome to Night Vale more than
exactly.
Something out of
it really
our
does.
Podcast.
Yeah,
so, okay, but can you give us like the very, very, very basics?
Yes. So optical clocks, they don't necessarily rely on just, let me put it this way. There are different types of optical clocks and they work on different types of particles, right? So with atomic clocks, we're typically talking about either cesium or rubidium.
Okay.
I think it's rubidium. But at any rate, we're only talking about those. The optical clocks, there are a lot more options. So you can talk about certain atoms or ions or even molecules, depending upon the type of optical clock you've got set up. And the optical clocks can correct for cesium clock drift, which is good. So they are more precise. They can divide time up into ever smaller amounts. And they are really, I mean, that's really important because the more precise you get, the more accurate your timekeeping is. But what they're essentially doing is slowing these atoms and ions and molecules down to microwave frequency standards, which is similar to what the cesium atomic clock does.
Okay.
So the idea being that light frequencies are way too fast. They're much faster than the microwave. Even with that 9 billion number, that's slow compared to what the light frequencies are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to use it to slow it down to these microwave amounts, but it means that you can actually create what's kind of called like an optical comb frequency, and you are able to subdivide those frequencies further and further and further, which is what allows us to look at smaller and smaller fractions of a second and make more and more precise clocks. And we have literally reached the limit of my understanding.
Okay. Okay. But part of my understanding of them is more top level than that. You just went way deeper than I did. but I'm aware of the idea that they're not considered as dependable as atomic clocks, and that's why they have not been used to switch over the definition of a second as of yet.
Yeah, they're incredibly complicated machines. And
no, they sound simple. What are you talking about?
There are a lot of potential points of failure. So if something goes wrong, the whole system doesn't work, right? And things go wrong. Technology doesn't always work, especially young technology, mm-hmm. where this is still relatively young technology, where you're trying to develop something. And because it's a delicate system and it's very complicated and downtime is a factor, that means you have to actually account for time required to fix the clock, which means that...
Yeah, like hours or even days.
Yeah. And so while it's offline, you aren't keeping
you don't have
that
a
time.
Clock.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unless you paired this type of system with another type of system, which is what essentially is up with this new clock that we mentioned at the very top of the podcast years and years ago.
Yeah, it seems like another lifetime, Lauren. So this, the story came from a research team, out of the National Metrology Institute of Germany. And metrology? That's the science of measurement.
Ooh.
And while there are branches of this institute all around the world, I think there's something so fitting
that it was the German.
That was the Germans, especially for time.
Yeah,
it's just again, it's stereotypical.
Yeah,
but you just think like it's very precise.
Say yes, very Prussian. Yes.
Yeah. So the specific type of clock that they were working with is a strontium optical lattice clock. By the way, there are research institutes in the United States that also are working on this same technology. And that's the actual optical clock. The optical lattice is pretty much what it sounds like. It's an arrangement of lasers that are meant to manipulate those atoms of strontium.
Okay.
So, again, back to the James Bond / Mission Impossible kind of trap. They use a second device to help account for time whenever the lattice clock goes offline. and that is a maser.
Maser?
Yeah.
It sounds like you made that up.
It sounds like it, but in fact, masers predate lasers. Masers were discovered or created in the lab before lasers were. They're similar to a laser. It is a microwave amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. So it used to be an acronym. Now it's just a word,
okay.
Just like laser.
Mm-hmm.
Masers operate at microwave frequencies, which, again, are not as high as laser frequencies, the light frequencies. Which means that because their frequencies are lower, I keep saying slower, but I really should just say lower. I know all the physicists out there have been
cringing this
exactly.
whole time.
I apologize to you guys. But it means that because you have a lower frequency, you have a lower level of precision. It's kind of like, you know, again, like the way I would think of it is imagine that you have, a measuring cup and you have a measuring cup. I've got a bucket.
Okay.
And we each have to say how much water is in a pool. And so it's going to take us a long time to figure this out, but you're going to be a lot more precise with your answer than I will.
Although you'll get to your answer quicker than I will.
Relatively so. I didn't say how big the pool was. I mean,
okay.
If it's a big enough pool, then both of us have just wasted our lives. At any rate, same idea with the maser. With the lower frequency, it can take less precise measurements. So what the team did was they used the maser to cover for the downtime when the optical clock was offline. And the way they did this was they then applied an optical frequency comb to divide the maser's measurements into smaller units, similar to that to the optical clocks. So while the optical clock was still working, they tuned the maser's frequency so that the output most closely resembled that of the optical clock once fed through this comb.
Clever.
Yeah.
Huh.
So they're like, well, the maser, while we know it cannot take as precise measurements as the optical clock, if we apply this optical comb to it, we can kind of fake it, mm-hmm. sort of. And as long as we have attuned the two together,
yeah.
then we can at least depend on this until we can get the other one working.
Sure, yeah. And then when the optical clock comes back online, then you reattune everything, make sure it's all flowing together, and kind of cut the difference.
Yeah, yeah. And then you might call people up and like, hey, I'm going to need that 6 nanoseconds back. Sorry.
Sorry, David.
Yeah, we're going to have to dock you 6 nanoseconds for you. You took too long for your lunch now.
But so in this experiment that this team published about recently, they ran a test of the system for 25 days,
mm-hmm.
and the optical clock did indeed experience downtime up to 2 days at a go. But at the end of the trial, their system was just under 0.2 nanoseconds off. And there's a kind of flashy number that the press has latched onto, and it's an extrapolation of that, which is that, okay, so assuming that the system wouldn't, like, degrade over a longer length of time,
mm-hmm.
and assuming that we could have somehow started running it at the beginning of the universe as we know it, aka, like, 14 billion years ago
like
or so.
When time became a thing.
Yes. This clock would have lost only about 100 seconds over those 14 billion some years.
So less than 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Over 14 billion.
Billion.
Years.
Yeah.
It's pretty precise.
Yeah, and atomic clocks are pretty good at that thing too, like relatively, but it beats them out by a factor of like 100.
Yeah.
So
ultimately, what does this mean about the future of timekeeping, the future of seconds themselves?
Well, okay, the definition of the SI unit isn't just going to change overnight.
Yeah, in fact, the researchers on this project said that it would be at least a decade out for that to change, partially because of
the technology,
yeah,
right? It's so young.
And we talked about the fact that there are all these different style of optical clocks. They don't all use strontium. They all may use something else. And we haven't figured out yet which one is, quote unquote, the best one to go with, as in the most reliable, the most precise. That has yet to be decided. This is still a very early form of research. So it may turn out that it'll take a decade for that to shake out and for us to say, all right, this is the optical clock that is best to use.
That we're going with, and this is what a second is now.
Yeah.
So when we do accomplish that, we'll have more accurate clocks, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But practically, what will that do for us?
Lots of stuff. Well, first of all, we here at Forward Thinking, we always stress that pure research ultimately benefits us in ways that we cannot anticipate.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and you know, like hurrah for the spirit of scientific inquiry and the advancement of physics and all that rad stuff. But But okay, like really technically, we're not doing all of this for us. Human beings don't miss the nanoseconds that the current, you know, gold standard atomic clocks are accidentally shaving off.
Right.
That means that, yes, in the spirit of Joe being not being here, but in his spirit, we're doing this for our robotic overlords.
Yeah, yeah. So it turns out, like, besides the satellite systems that we depend upon, we have a lot of systems here on Earth that are really important to coordinate with timekeeping, including things like our electric grid. But obviously, if we're going to have more and more technology interacting with one another, talking to one another, causing things to happen within our world, timekeeping becomes incredibly important. Obviously,
oh, yeah.
Like if I am walking into a room and I want a specific outcome to happen through my technology, I want that to happen while I'm walking into the room, not 5 minutes after I walked into the room or 5 minutes after I walked out of the room.
Sure. If you have a GPS system that's controlling your autonomous vehicle and another person's autonomous vehicle, you want those GPS satellites to be able to hone in on you well enough to not crash them together.
Right. If you have a system that is and like an external system that's controlling a lot of vehicles, you could, in theory, reduce traffic to nothing, right? Because you could have the cars moving impossibly close to one another, incredibly safely. But if your timekeeping's off, that suddenly becomes a lot of bumping and rubbing
because
on the road.
Time and distance are still linked.
Yeah.
And or for another example, so back in February of 2014, we did an episode about how machines run the stock market. Computers are very precisely running the stock market these days, making these trades at fractions of a second.
Mm-hmm.
The episode is called Show Me the 00100100.
Yeah.
If you'd like to go look for it.
I believe that code actually stands for the dollar sign.
That's adorable.
Yeah, I think I actually looked that up. That's how much of a dork I am.
But so obviously this kind of precision and timekeeping will totally matter to these computers and to others like them. You know, just think, Jonathan, how many interactions and transactions you could complete in a few extra nanoseconds every day.
Man, my Amazon wish list is going to be sick. Yeah. So we've been joking around a lot and talking kind of about this somewhat odd idea of a second. Time is such a weird thing, right?
Yeah.
To talk about in a objective, definitive way when we also are aware that it is relative, it makes it really kind of mind-bendy to go on about this. And ultimately, if we get to a future where people are zooming around the galaxy at ridiculous speeds, this kind of precise timekeeping will also be important so that we can have any form of communication that might be possible as long as they're still, you know, within reachable distances.
Right, right.
And who knows?
Or going the speed of light, yeah.
Yeah, if they're going the speed of light, then you're never going to catch up to them. Like, the message will always be behind them until they stop. And then what will happen is they'll travel at the speed of light and they'll be like 27 light years away, and then they'll stop and then they'll say, "You forgot your underwear." I'm like, no.
Oh, I'm just thinking of that bump in your inbox when you finally slowed down.
You were so proud of having inbox
finally,
zero.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden,
it's like, oh my gosh, and it's all ads. So this was fun to talk about something like this. And we really look forward to tackling other interesting topics like this in the future. If you guys have any suggestions for future topics, maybe there's something you've always wondered, how is that going to be, what will that be like in the future? Let us know. Send us an email. The address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or you can drop us a line on social media. On Twitter, we are fwthinking. If you search fwthinking over on Facebook, our profile will pop right up. You can leave us a message there. We'll be happy to hear from you, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.